everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Yes, it's me, Michael Steele. I'm in the house tonight, and we're having a lot of fun here as we see impeachments underway and all this new evidence is popping and people around Washington are all kind of abuzz. It's, you know, it's a little bit like Christmas all over again. Well, not really. Anyway, I'm so glad you could be a part of the conversation. Certainly, you can follow me on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to do that download thing. We love it when you do that. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And of course, you know, we always have fun there too. So this conversation today I've been looking forward to because I have mad respect for my guest. I have had the pleasure of being in rooms with him, watching him, listening to him. We talk about how the party is now bereft of big thinkers on the Republican side, on the conservative side. I'm here to tell you we're not. We got some brothers in the house, and you're going to hear one of them today. His name is David French. He's a senior editor at The Dispatch and a columnist for Time. He has authored many books, including A Season for Justice, Home and Away, and The Rise of ISIS. His next book, which we're going to get him back on to talk about, Divided We Fall, will be released in 2020, sometime this year. And he's also a former major in the United States Reserve, Army Reserves. He served, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, in Iraq, right, David French?
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Welcome to the podcast, man.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
No, it's a real treat. And David and I were talking a little bit before we started knocking this out about he represents some interesting thoughts on a number of areas which we want to get into. One having, of course, to do with the killing of Qasman Soleimani, the Iraqi general, and then of course. What's going on recently with the whole Ukrainian thing. And it's before we get into that, just sort of give me a sense, David, of how you're seeing where we are right now. You've got these two big, huge events. Certainly the president's dealings with the Ukrainian president and all that's now come out of that leading to impeachment. And then, of course, this military action. But there's so many other pieces on this very dramatic stage. How do you assess this administration, this president, this time as we get ready to go into one of the most fierce political seasons in our lifetimes, I think?
Right. Well, I think you've got that right. I think 2020 is going to make 2016 look like the golden age of civility. I think on the Soleimani, on the strike against Soleimani and the immediate crisis with Iran, and I with the emphasis on immediate,
right.
The immediate crisis with Iran has eased. The long-term conflict is still there, and we can talk about the impact of killing Soleimani on the long-term crisis, but I think that immediate impact or that immediate crisis is eased for a bit, thankfully. I think on the Ukraine situation, what is happening with Ukraine is twofold. One, it's its own discrete event. In other words, it's its own thing that it describes how Trump treated a particular ally in a particular snapshot of time. But it also lifts the lid on the larger Trump administration and the way Trump views foreign policy, the way Trump merges his self-interest with the national interest. And I think there are really two aspects of the Ukraine scandal. One is if you look at the events themselves, what were the precise abuses in that circumstance that Trump
Right.
committed? What were the abuses of power? Sort of looking at it the way you would look at an allegation of criminal activity. The other one is, what does it say about the nature of the administration? And I think in both of those circumstances, it's profoundly negative. There was a profound
Right.
abuse of power by Trump, and it revealed profoundly negative things about Trump.
So can I go down a level on the first part of that, on the
Sure.
abuse of power? Could you explain to me why the hell Republicans don't see what this man did as an abuse of power. I mean, I just want to shake him and say, well, please describe to me, what do you think an abuse of power would look like? So if the president of the United States called up another government and said, hey, I want you to come and interfere in our elections. I want you to help me win my reelection. Oh, and by the way, I need you to investigate an American citizen for me and give me whatever dirt you can so that will help me in my election. You don't see that as an abuse of power. I help me understand the rationale, or is it just rationalization? Just rationalize it away, and that way you don't have to deal with it. Explain on it. You just kind of go, oh, no, that's not an abuse, and move on to something else. I don't see how they do that.
Well, I think that there are sort of three categories of GOP senators and congressmen here. One is probably the smallest category would be the very people who have expressed outward concern. So like say the Mitt Romneys of right. the world, and maybe that's Mitt Romney.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that's a group of one. Okay.
So you have that group that they have said what they think. Okay. Then there's another group that believes what Mitt Romney believes, but you couldn't wring that out of them if you tried.
Right.
And that might be the biggest group, particularly in the Senate, actually.
Right.
And you understand this dynamic quite well, but, some of the listeners might not fully grasp the predicament these GOP senators are in, because if you come out hard against Trump, a lot of them with a lot of justification view that as the end of their political career.
Right.
And so they're weighing, is this moment so important as to sacrifice my political career? And, you know, a lot of people, they run for office thinking that they have something unique and powerful to add to the public conversation, and they're not quite sure that they want their voice. They're not sure that they want their voice to be silenced over, you know, outrage X or outrage Y. They think they've got something important to say and do, and so they don't want to end their career. And so they don't. Now, the irony of it, for some of them, they may end their career anyway.
Right.
Because let's say they're in a swing state, and if they came out hard against Trump, they might face an impossible primary challenge. But by supporting Trump, an awful lot of those suburban voters that deserted the GOP in 2018 will desert them in 2020. And they're sort of in this, you know, darned if you do, darned if you don't. And my argument would be, I mean, come on. if you're kind of in a pickle either way, do the right thing. And then there's this sort of third category that of really true Trump believer. And I think that's probably a minority of the GOP caucus in the Senate. It might be a majority of the GOP caucus in the House, especially since a lot of the swing district Republicans were tossed out of office in 2018.
Right. I guess for me, having served in office, having taken the oath of office, sworn to uphold the Constitution of the United States and as well as the Constitution of the state of Maryland, for me, I guess my point is, and you frame it well, and it makes sense, I guess, that they don't want to sacrifice that great thing that they think they're going to do over something small and trivial related to Trump. But the reality of it is, I think, David, is that there is nothing small or trivial related to Trump. It's all
right.
Big stuff, because it goes to the heart and core of what we are, what we believe, what we stand for. I mean, the institutions, whether it's, you know, NSA, CIA, FBI, the ideas of what that lady standing in, you know, New York Harbor stands for with that torch in her arms, you know, in her hand, saying, you know, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. All these things that we have come to value have been devalued. And so my attitude is, if you're not willing to risk your political seat to stand up for that lady in the harbor, for those immigrants who want to come to this country, for the citizens who are trying to make a better life for themselves here at home, for our allies and relationships around the globe, then what are you willing to sacrifice it for? And I guess that's the test of these times, that a lot of people seem to be failing, in my view.
Well, you know, I think that what's happening, and I see this when I talk to evangelical friends of mine, and I say, look, guys, okay, I understand where you're coming from on you like this policy or that policy from Donald Trump, but for the last generation before Trump came, you said to the American people as loudly as you possibly could things like character matters.
Yes.
Honesty matters. Knowledge, integrity, they all matter. And now you're saying none of it matters as long as you get judges or you get this regulatory reform or you get that regulatory reform. None of it matters at all. And what you end up doing is you replace a principled constitutionalism with a more like some sort of Machiavellian approach to politics, or, you know, almost Nietzschean will to power. And so all that matters is the attainment of power, and what you ensure, maybe you can rationalize it by saying I can accomplish this good thing or that good thing while I have power.
Right.
But that what they don't realize is that they are degrading the very social fabric of this country.
Exactly.
As they do it. And they don't even view that as a loss.
No. No, they don't.
That's the thing that keeps, you know, that's the thing that I finally realized. National unity, division, contention, confusion, exhaustion, all of those things, I think they now just believe are the cost of doing business in politics. And the business of politics is winning, getting a few policy wins, and then rolling back all the fighting. And we just can't, our system cannot keep going down this road. I mean, this is, we're reaching a dangerous point, and I hope and pray that tempers will be cool enough in 2020 to where we won't reach the kind of breaking point that we've reached in the past in this country. I mean, in the lifetimes of probably many of your listeners, they can remember the bombings and the fires and the riots of the 1960s. And it's not like the human nature has improved for the better since then. So, you know, I'm very nervous about what we're about to encounter in 2020.
Well, you raise a lot of very important and interesting points. And I think, because you and I think, are on the same page in that regard. And for me, it was summed up in an article by what was this gentleman's name? I forget real quick. Charles Blow. That came out just a couple of days ago. To beat Trump, put ideals before ideas. And he opens it up by saying, Democrats face a real dilemma. The current crop of their party's presidential candidates are awash in plans and proposals, which in theory is a good thing. But this election will not be decided on that basis. I've been saying this for over a year. Donald Trump has transformed the electorate into two camps, sycophants and dissidents. Both passionate, both aimed like missiles at November, both with an intent desire to destroy the competition. This election won't turn on the definition of Medicare for all or its funding mechanisms. It won't turn on who offers free college or to whom. This election will turn on whether an individual voter sees Trump as a heroic savior or a destructive agent. It is about what we value and what we put forth as a representation of us. I put it this way in the 2018 cycle, and I'm going to tweet this out again this November, so y'all just get ready because you're going to see it. When you go to the polls and you're assessing these candidates, ask yourself, what kind of government do you want, and what kind of leaders do you want to run it? Because we got to keep in mind that we, the people, are the government. So what kind of government you want is going to be a reflection of who we are as people. And this election boils down to that for me. And it really is sycophants or dissidents. You know, it's going to be, my God, he's Moses come down from Mount Sinai, or he's Satan come up from hell.
Well, that'll be the way the wings, the sort of the extremes of our political discourse will categorize it, no matter who the Democratic nominee is,
right.
I mean, you're going to have this argument, and we've heard it all before. This is the most important election of our lifetime. If the Republicans lose, it's the end of the Republic, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, one of the interesting things about the political dynamic that I've been looking at is there's a lot of research now that says that there is something called an exhausted majority in the American electorate.
They're real people.
Yeah. That the political wings are really driving the public conversation on a day-to-day basis. They're the ones who are producing candidates through the primary system. And this sort of exhausted majority is sort of choosing from the menu of candidates selected by the political activists on the other each side. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder if it is possible for a person to run on a platform of right that includes as a vital component of it turning down the temperature of political discourse, reconciliation, national unity. And if somebody like that can beat the person who runs on the platform of nonstop fighting all the time, you know, the constant war of real America against fake America, then you're going to provide a disincentive for future candidates to replicate that, mm-hmm. that continual combat. And I don't know, I might be wildly optimistic to think that's possible. But I hope that it is, because we really need it.
Well, okay, so digging down a little bit deeper, you raised the conversation that you've had with your evangelical friends. I can't even begin to tell you what the conversation with my evangelical friends go like, because I have folks who listen to this podcast, and I've said this before, you know, I do not tolerate hypocrisy in any form, and I tolerate it the least from the religious community. Having been in a religious institution as a former seminarian, that is such a sensitive issue for me. You wrote a great piece last June, if I recall, about the religious culture war in this country. And you talked about some painful truths related to America's war, the culture war around religion. Talk to me about how that plays into what we see happening now and what that may mean, not just for this election cycle, but even if Trump loses, what does that say about where we are as Americans when you consider, you know, how much this our country was founded with this sense of divine purpose, and yet we seem to struggle against that and sometimes overcompensate for it?
Well, one of the first things people have to understand who are sort of outside the evangelical community, and I'm an evangelical myself, I can't even remember growing up at a time. I mean, from the moment I first grew up, we were in church every Sunday and Wednesday nights as well.
And, right.
And one of the first things you have to realize, especially amongst politically engaged Christians, which are not all of them, not even most of them probably, but amongst those who are politically engaged, there is a giant amount of fear. And that is the fundamental driving factor here. It is an enormous amount of fear. It is a belief that if you lose an election, you're going to lose all your liberty. It's a belief that the culture has turned decisively against you, that your way of life is slipping away. And so instead of a community that should be characterized by hope and faith, you have a community, at least the political facing side of it, is characterized by fear and rage.
Right.
And that's the opposite of the way, you know, Scripture says God did not give us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and a
right.
sound mind. And
exactly.
And so what you've got is a community characterized by fear rather than hope and rage rather than faith. And a lot of that is falsely stoked. A lot of that, a lot of people would be super surprised to learn that in your typical evangelical church, a pastor never talks about politics from the pulpit. Never. And a lot of evangelicals have the sum total of sort of their theological instruction on how Christians are to interact with politics is sort of, hey, it's important that you get engaged. And that big void is often filled by activists, mm-hmm. who are constantly bombarding them with emails saying the end is near.
Right.
It's The void is filled by primetime Fox News. The void is filled by talk radio. And I'm sorry, those are terrible theological teachers.
Right?
Just terrible. And so I will talk to Christian audiences and I'll say, how many people believe that, we have more religious liberty in 2019 than we did 30 years ago or less? And almost every hand will go up to say we have less. And
right.
The fact of the matter is we have more.
We have more, yeah. Yeah.
And I'll say, how many people believe that the abortion rate in the U.S. was higher in 2019 than it was in 1989? And every hand will go up and say it's higher now. No, it's far less. The abortion rate is lower than it was before Roe was decided. You know, so these are huge advances that have been made by the, you know, social conservative movement. And yet it's consumed with the idea that it's one election away from extinction.
Yeah, no, look, I tell you, I want to recommend this piece to folks, you know, sort of as a backdrop to this conversation, this part of our conversation, so you understand it, because you really touched on, I think, some important elements of the overarching, you know, concern that folks like myself have who've been in both worlds. In the religious world and the political world. And so, you know, what that means when you're an elected official, what that means when you're a political player versus what that means as a Christian. And you touch on some of these you know, these truths that create this sort of tension. And there was one particular part of it, I had to pull it up. You quote in here, you say, not one Christian parent has to take his or her child to see a drag queen at the library. But all too many Christian parents have had to explain the moral collapse of pastors and church leaders to their kids. All too many Christian wives have had to deal with the devastation of a husband addicted to porn. And all too many Christian spouses have had to pick up the pieces after infidelity and divorce. And that just that's where we are. That's the space we're in, where Christians and non-Christians alike, that sort of ethics, that sort of morality, that code of what's appropriate, what's good, what's bad, all of that's now sort of smudged up against each other and smashed together. And as you notice, you know, we're really good at, you know, understanding our own failings, but not really respecting the failings of others. You know, so it's how do we work through that? Because that, to me, sort of is the culture poisoning or you know, I guess poisoning everything else, if you will, using culture to represent everything from religion to theater, art. You know what I'm saying? Am I making sense?
Yeah, but,
I hope I'm making sense.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't want to sound dumb in front of a smart guy like you. So.
No. So what you have is sort of a partisan infection of the brain. So if you talk to an evangelical in 1998 and you said, isn't it really, really important that our president not get away with having an affair in the Oval Office, lying about it under oath? Doesn't that have real cultural impact? Doesn't that send a cultural message to people about infidelity, about marriage vows, about honesty and integrity? And Christians would have said, yes, absolutely, 100% yes. And before the rise of Trump, if you talk to Christians and you ask them, what are we dealing with in our families? And they would say, we deal with broken families. We deal with infidelity. We've got real problems with porn. And then now they're backing a president who, wait for it, was in a Playboy softcore porn video, who had three marriages, who has, you know, had been through, has broken his family three times. I mean, had an affair with a porn star. You know?
Right. Right.
And then they say, well, it's, you know, you have to support him. What are you talking about? I mean, I want to reintroduce you to your 1998 self.
Right.
Because your 1998 self would not recognize your 2015 self. In fact, your 1998 self would be insulted if I told you that in 20 short years that you would be reversing yourself on every major position you're staking right now with Clinton.
I know. It is amazing. It's something that I grapple with in trying to understand the yin and the yang of, you know, Does culture drive our politics? Our politics drive our culture? How does all of that play out? Because you put it exactly right, you know, which is why I always have a problem with people who project backwards. So they project an attitude back in time. So we feel enlightened and smart about this subject today, and then we cast aspersions when something is revealed that 20 years ago, John behaved a certain way that was, you know, now deemed inappropriate, but at the time was oh so appropriate. And I can't help but think of Justice Kavanaugh, because at the time that he and because I grew up, I was in the area with him. I grew up with him in this time. I know this time in which he got caught up in that behavior. I know guys who attended those kinds of parties. I didn't, but I know guys who did. And the fact of the matter is, to project the attitude today, sort of a Me Too attitude back 20, 30 years, it kind of misses the mark almost. And it creates, I think, a level of self-righteousness that blinds us to how we really should be looking at elevating ourselves and moving forward in a good way, which I think we want to do. But we, you know, as you note in here, you know, you just sort of get this attitude and this sort of judgmental tone where you tend not to consider the faults of others in the same way you would consider your own faults, because you would say, well, that was 20 years ago. You know, that's what we did. But then when you see someone else doing it, you're like, well, how dare he? He should know better. Why? I can't believe it, you know?
Well, you know, one of the things, the interesting thing about the 19, because I think there's so many instructive parallels between the Clinton era and the Trump era. And one of the things that when Clinton was behaving the way he behaved, and when Clinton did what he did, that Christians in response to it cited eternal principles.
Right.
In response.
Yeah.
And basic moral common sense. I'll give you a perfect example of flip-flopping. In 1998, Franklin Graham wrote in the Wall Street Journal that if Bill Clinton would lie to his wife and daughter, who will he not lie to? And fair point, right? That's
right.
A fair point.
Fair point.
In 2018, he says, you know, the stuff between Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels is just between him and his wife.
and see, that's the stuff I have a problem with. But okay, I'm following your point. I'm with you.
Then in 2019, he says he raises issues about Pete Buttigieg's same-sex marriage. So I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Okay, so the only thing that I'm getting here is that you're purely partisan.
Right.
Because you'll condemn a Democratic president, you'll give a Republican president a pass, and then along comes the next Democratic presidential candidate, and you'll condemn him. So it's not that he's maybe not even hypocritical. Maybe he's just consistently partisan.
Right.
And we use whatever argument that he can find. And that's what I mean by the partisan infection. What the partisan infection does is it makes you just grab whatever argument you can find that's handy to defend your side. And, you know, it's the old statement about lawyers, you know, when you have the facts, argue the facts. When you have the law, argue the law. When you have neither the facts or the law, pound the table.
Right, right.
And you see a lot of table pounding these days, an awful lot of table pounding, and an awful lot of people essentially acting as unpaid defense attorneys for the Trump administration. Why? Because they're purely partisan.
So is there a salve for that? Is a balm we can put on those sores? Is there a potion we can take to cure what's ailing our innards when it comes to that? Because I love this idea of a partisan infection, because that's exactly what it is. It is the essence of tribalism in so many ways. So what do we do? How do we get better from that?
I mean,
Dr. French.
Well, if you have ideas, I'm open to them. But
right.
I'll tell you, there are two things I think a lot about. One is we have to have a personal transformation, and the other one is we need to think about a political transformation. The personal transformation is this: is we have to substitute intolerance for true tolerance. In other words, you know, look, the idea we have to get used to the idea that America is an incredibly pluralistic, diverse society, that people of diametrically opposed points of view don't just live together in this country. They work side by side together in neighboring cubicles. And that without surrendering our core convictions about what's right and wrong, about what's true or false, about faith and politics and culture, we have to have a degree of tolerance, not just for the existence of the person next to us, but also a degree of a desire for them to flourish in this country, for their families to flourish, and for mm-hmm. them to flourish personally. And so that's the personal side of this. The political side of this is, I think we've got to lower the temperature of national politics, and we've got to increase the importance of local politics, because one of the things that makes this atmosphere so toxic is that with the growth of the power of the presidency, the retreat of the power of Congress, that every 4 years, it's not that we have the most important election every 4 years, but every 4 years we are electing the most powerful peacetime leader of this country, because mm-hmm. the power of the presidency keeps growing. And so that means that president has a disproportionate amount of influence over the course of affairs of your local community. And if for that matter, congressional leaders as well. Nancy Pelosi needs to be less relevant to Tennessee, and Ted Cruz needs to be less relevant to San Francisco.
Yes.
And so we have to relearn federalism to lower the temperature of national politics. Now, that'll increase the temperature of local politics, but that's fine. We can handle that.
And that's how it should be. That's how the founders, right. I believe, wanted it to be, which is why they were concerned about political parties and an imperial presidency and you know, grand big government. They created this republic. And I remind people, you know, oh, democracy. No, we practice democracy. We are a republic. I mean, so, you know, that's, you got to understand what that means, how we contextualize this stuff. It's all about what you just said there, is that local flavor. That's what drives it. It's from the bottom up. And you begin, I think, in that sense, David, to begin to address a lot of the angers and the frustrations that have now bubbled up to the point where they've become nationalized. And someone like Trump can come in and play that fiddle all day long, because he's going to strike a chord. That's why I tell people, you know, my friends on the West Coast, I said, y'all don't realize you got as many Trumpers out here as we do in the southern parts of the country, as we do, you know, anywhere else, because that anger and that frustration has bubbled up from the bottom, and is now, you know, like scum sitting on the surface, you know, and he just plays with it all day long.
Well, you know, there used to be this saying, and you know, you're a longtime political pro. You've heard it a million times. All politics is local.
Yep.
But it's shifting. It's all politics is national now. I didn't know that I would ever see the day that I saw in November of 2018, when a whole bunch of people started parsing election returns for local elections in the suburbs of Philadelphia.
Right.
For what they said about Donald Trump's chances in 2020.
Right.
It was remarkable. Or looking at the precinct level voting patterns in suburban Kentucky, suburban Lexington and suburban Louisville, and the defeat of Governor Bevin, the Republican governor mm-hmm. of Kentucky, to tell us, to see what it says sort of about suburbs in general for 2020. All politics is local. It's moving increasingly national, and I think that's a problem.
Well, we're gonna take a break and explore a little bit more when we come back. What is happening nationally? Certainly, in the face of the impeachment storyline that's developing and unfolding, and a whole lot more with our great guest David French. We'll be right back. And 3, 2, 1. All right. So David, I got a little, you know, you hit that religious chord for me, and I was off to the races, and I appreciate you dancing with me. You know, I love those conversations, because I think they get to the core of a lot of what ails us. So let's sort of go a little top line here and talk about some of the bigger stories that are also shaping the narrative for the country right now. Certainly impeachment is a big driver in this case. What's your assessment of this ongoing impeachment storyline? How do you think the president will play this out, and the Democrats as well? Right now there seems to be a little bit of a of a standoff, if you will. I guess the real action will begin once we get into full trial mode. But what's your assessment of where things are right now and what we as citizens should be taking from it as the story unfolds?
Well, I'd say don't presume we can predict everything, but we probably can.
Right. Hey, fair point.
I would say that one thing that is going to be unpredictable about the proceedings is that, as we saw in this past week with new information coming from Lev Parnas,
right,
that this is going to be a unique impeachment proceeding in that we may get new evidence relevant to the proceedings immediately before, like we just did, during, and perhaps even after.
Yeah.
Because this is an unfolding investigation, both by Congress and by the media. And so, you know, what's different between, say, the Nixon and the Clinton impeachment efforts, and with Clinton, Ken Starr investigated for a very long time, plopped down a very comprehensive report, and impeachment was off to the races. With Nixon, there was a long simmering investigation, key court decisions, you hear the tapes, and mm-hmm. you're off to the races. And here, it's a different process, in part because what the Trump administration did is they released the blue dress right away.
Yes.
They released the Watergate tapes right away. They dumped the worst piece of evidence for Trump, which was the memoranda of the conversation, into the public square immediately, which was Trump himself conditioning American aid on investigation of Biden and a crazy conspiracy theory about CrowdStrike, and then everything else has been filling in the details.
Right.
We have more details to fill in, and we'll likely fill in more details. But this was going to be a strange trial, and that evidence will be unfolding as the trial is going. And so that's the only thing that I would say introduces any element of unpredictability. The predictability is he will not be convicted.
Right.
The unpredictability is, will he get Democratic votes to acquit? Will there be a majority to convict? I mean, these are kinds of questions that we don't know the answer to, and they matter politically. But I would say the chances of him, you know, maybe on Earth 2, he could be convicted. But on Earth 1, I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't see it, not because the evidence won't be there or isn't there already for that. Because, from what I've learned and read and looked at, yeah, this is a real problem for me. And if I were the United States Senate,
yeah,
I'd still want to go through the trial and the process, but I'm like, now you have to convince me that you really did talk about corruption at some point, because I just right now don't see the evidence. So the script is flipped for Republicans the other way, in which, you know, Lindsey Graham tells us 3 weeks ago, I don't care what they come up with. I'm not supporting anything. I'm not even going to look at anything. You know, you've got, you know, Congressman Collins during the House hearings, you know, sitting back in his chair, pretty much, you know, with his legs on the table, yawning. Lindsey Graham, yes, you know, during the ceremonial start of this, there was this great shot of him yawning and looking utterly bored. So you know where they're coming and going on this. So
that's just trolling.
Yes. Yes. And so I guess the question then becomes, how do Americans process this? Because I don't think we really know yet how Americans are processing this. Now, we know 71% from some of the latest polls are saying we want to see witnesses. We want to hear them. We like to see the evidence if it's there. If the Republicans deny that, does that stick in the craw with the American people? Enough that, okay, we put that in the negative box for Republicans or for the president. How do you think they are processing this right now?
Well, you know, I think there's two layers of processing. One is processing from the standpoint of how will you vote in 2020.
Right.
And the other one is sort of processing from the standpoint of what would I like to see my senator do? Which is not the same.
They're not the same. Right. They're not necessarily the same. Right. Right.
So So I do think that the Republicans are playing a losing hand and trying to say, if they try to argue that, hey, we don't want to hear from the National Security Advisor,
right?
The former National
Security, right?
That's really hard to justify anywhere except Fox primetime or talk radio.
Yeah.
That's just really hard to justify. So you're going to have, and that's where some of these senators might pay a price in 2020, in that they actively stopped Americans from hearing information and hearing the truth. And that would be a prime attack ad to run in a swing state. So that's, Mitch McConnell, I think his number one priority isn't defending Trump. It's actually defending his Senate majority, which are, again, those are not quite the same thing. So that's one side of it. From the standpoint of voting in 2020, a lot of Trump's defenders point to the fact that his overall approval rating hasn't really gone up or down during this impeachment process.
Yeah, it's pretty much where it's been from the beginning. Yeah.
Right around 42%.
Yeah.
And they sort of get cocky about that.
Yeah.
But you know what? 42% isn't a lot.
No, it's not.
And the more you lock in the president at that 42%, because ideally you don't have to have a majority approval rating to win re-election. Obama often had a lower than majority approval rating.
Yeah.
But you want to bump above that 42% pretty regularly, even with your electoral college advantage. You can't get cocky at 42%. What's really amazing to me is the just unbelievable confidence that so many Republicans have about that 42%. And that to me, we've almost replaced. In 2016, we had a theory that was conventional wisdom, which was Trump's going to lose. Trump is a garbage candidate. He's going to lose. That was conventional wisdom. And it was proven to be wrong.
Right.
And it's been replaced in some Republican circles by an opposite assumption, which is Trump is magic.
Fairy dust.
And I think that that's wrong. I think that we have to look at this more sober-minded and say, perhaps 3 years of consistent polling pegging him at around 42% are a danger sign. And if the Democrats don't nominate somebody as disliked as Hillary Clinton, they're going to have to like their chances pretty well, even in the face of a big, a good economy.
Right. So on that point, then, we just watched the last Democratic debate before the caucuses begin in Iowa in a couple of weeks. And, the whole Hillary, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren sort of kerfuffle was fun. It's a nice little sidebar thing. Dumb. Two people having a conversation over, lasagna, clearly weren't listening to each other. So you got that. And, a lot of folks, a lot of progressives are like, oh, we can't have this fight. Meanwhile, Joe Biden is sitting there being Uncle Joe. And no matter how you cut this thing from day one of his entry into this campaign to the day, he has been, by every metric, the guy that your rank and file Democrats want. So in the end, does it make more sense for the Democrats to look to the point you were just making at someone like a Joe Biden who could be a beneficiary in the 2020 cycle as opposed to roadkill?
Well, the question I have about Joe Biden is really pretty simple. Is he up for the fight?
Yeah.
Is he up for it?
Yeah.
I think that rarely has there been a yellow brick road to the presidency paved as clearly for a candidate as it's been paved for Joe Biden.
Yeah.
He for a long time now, he has been the front runner, not just in Democratic primary polling. He's been the front runner in presidential general election polling.
Yeah. Yeah.
He has a rapport with working class white voters in the Midwest that very few of the other Democrats have, maybe Bernie to some extent. So he's sort of like, if you were going to construct a candidate in a lab to beat Donald Trump, also he has an incredible relationship with African American voters in many parts of the country.
Right.
So if you're going to build a candidate in a lab to beat to beat Donald Trump, it would be a Joe Biden minus 10 years.
Exactly. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, because that 10 years you're talking about is the only real hesitation that people have, even within his own party. Now, the progressives notwithstanding, even among some of them, they're like, yeah, but he's too old. You know, even in the main fight of things, they're like, oh, yeah, but he's too old. I agree with you. I think he can hold up in the fight. There's just something, I think, for Joe, the switch getting out of a primary when it's clear that he is the nominee, I think you see a completely different guy. I think you see a completely I think this part of it, he's like, okay, I know I got to go through this. I know I got to go through this. I know I got to go through this. But once he gets past this, I think you see something different in him, because then he knows then he gets to define what the fight is about. Right now,
Yeah. He also has a very different opponent. And so,
right.
You know, right now, Uncle Joe is known for his Bidenisms.
Right.
He's never been the most sharp, eloquent, articulate political campaigner. And he's running up against people like Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren, who are hyper articulate.
Right.
Bernie, who knows his talking points cold. And then in a general election, he'll be going up against the walking word salad of
right.
Donald Trump.
Exactly.
And so it would alter the perception a little bit. Like in that kind of, in a debate, rather than, you know, Biden's kind of wandering answers contrasting unfavorably with Buttigieg and Warren's like super sharp policy
wonk. Right.
I've read all the charts in Vox.com. He's going to be going against, you know, Donald Trump, who's, you know, saying, I have the best words.
Right.
And it's going to be a different dynamic.
And people will be sitting there going, well, I actually understand what Joe just said.
You know, yeah.
Whereas before, you know what's interesting, though, having said that, it made me think about a conversation I had last night with a gentleman. And we started talking about Joe, and he was, you know, doing the whole, oh my God, you know, he's so old, he's decrepit, da 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 da. And he said, and the way he talks, I said, you know, he has a stutter, right?
Right.
And he went, really? I said, yeah. I said, he's finally decided to be honest about his stutter, and he now speaks from time to time, you know, when it happens, and he tries to control, so it's not really bad. And you could see the transformation in his face. He was like, oh, I didn't know that. He said, well, oh, that makes so much more sense. So I guess I have to look at him differently. You know, it was just really weird. That
yeah.
So you were sitting there, we're talking about the sort of word salad of Trump. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, people say, now I understand Joe. They'll understand him better and clearer with his stutter than the word salad that Trump throws out there with everything being the best, the biggest, the greatest, fill in the blank. And it's it makes for the fact that both of these men are going to be comfortable in the skin that they have. And I think that's
right.
The point that Joe is looking forward to getting to. And he's halfway there. He's kind of that moment he had with that kid where he said, you know, I have a stutter too. And he did that. And then, of course, when he did it on the stage in the debate before this one, and the world reacted to that, some on our side negatively, who got slapped back on it. I thought it was a very empowering moment for him. You know, it's interesting. So it'll be interesting to see how Trump deals with that. Cause I could see Trump actually making fun of his stutter at some point.
I could see him doing it in a debate.
In a debate. Absolutely. And Joe, yeah. And I think would own that moment in a way that any other candidate would not. And that's what I'm curious about, how asymmetrical a Joe Biden can be versus some of the other candidates when they're up against someone like Trump. Because it's not just about, oh, I can go toe-to-toe with Trump. No, it's about can you think like he does? And I think two 70-year-old men kind of understand how to think like each other from time to time. But what do I know?
Yeah, Donnie from Queens, Joe from Scranton.
Right, exactly. So before I let you get out of here, I can't, because I've always been admiring fan of, you know, your work at National Review and the projects that, you know, you've been involved in over the years, and certainly the product that you put out with the Dispatch, which would highly recommend people take a look at. You're one of the few. I mean, people ask me all the time, why are you still a Republican, right? And and I tell them, Dave, I said, I'm like a Motel 6. Someone's got to keep the lights on, right? So, I want to say that, you know, you're one of these guys who are standing on the front porch with a light bulb too, and I appreciate that. But you've been clear in calling out things that the administration or the president in particular have said or done that have been problematic. And I appreciate that. How has that been for you? I mean, what brought you to that moment? Was there a triggering mechanism? It was just the totality of it. How did you evolve into that space where you're like, damn it, these principles do matter and I'm going to stand and fight for them?
You know, I think it was a combination of two things at once. I mean, one was, as the primary went from 2015 to 2016, and you began to realize that Trump's not just a leading contender, he's the overwhelming favorite to win this thing.
Right.
And so you really, at that point, have to face, do you want this guy to represent you in any way, shape, or form? And for me, you know, his core values, his temperament, his judgment, his history, many of his policies, I didn't want him to represent me. And so from a policy, personality, integrity, character standpoint, I reached a point as the primaries started to roll where I just said, no,
right.
No, I'm not, he cannot, he's not my standard bearer in any way, shape, or form. So, and then the other thing that's different, and that's not just completely Trump focused, is I began to be really alarmed by the effect that he was having on the people around me, both in the conservative movement more broadly, sort of the elite conservative mm-hmm. movement, but also just a lot of regular folks who are heavily engaged in politics. That's the qualifier, heavily engaged in politics.
Right,
he doesn't
right.
have much of an effect on people who don't pay that much attention to politics. But those people who are heavily engaged in politics, conservative movement figures, I began to see the Trumpification of these people, that they were also believing character didn't matter, that they were also mm-hmm. more prone to use lies to try to abuse and harm their opponents rather than defeat them in the marketplace of ideas. And I began to see this Trumpification, and it's just continued. And it's gotten worse. In some ways, it's accelerated. So I felt like it was incredibly important not just to stand against Trump, the man, but also to stand against the Trumpification of a movement. And that has been challenging.
Yeah, yeah.
Shall we say, that has been challenging.
Well put. It is a challenge. But, you know, look, it's just one that I think is an important challenge that we have to meet, because I've been in this game in the party since the mid-70s, and I can't, you know, my attitude is I ain't going nowhere. And so because these things still matter, and you've got to face that challenge. You've got to face up to it in some kind of way and make it clear to everybody what still matters. And, you know, not give in to the easy of, you know, dumbing down the things that you value or dumbing down relationships or institutions to the lowest possible denominator and saying, okay, this is the new space. This is where we are. This is who we are. I'm like, no, I think we're called to something higher and better than that. So we don't put kids in cages. We don't tell people their legacy is a shithole or they live in the worst city in America or, you know, our gold star families aren't valued. You got to place a value on stuff. It's got to mean something. Or it means.
Well, right. Like the Washington Post article today about the way he treats American generals. You know,
yes.
Call people who've laid their lives on the lines
yes.
for the country dopes and babies.
And this is the guy who punked out of serving. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, telling men and women who have, at great sacrifice and risk, that, you know, you don't know what you're doing. You have no idea. I'm like, okay. So, see, but of course, they're better than me because, see, I cuss them out and move on. But that's, you know, that's me. That's, That's just who I am. I'll just call it a day. David French, he's one of the best folks, senior editor at The Dispatch and a columnist for Time. Check out his new book. David, when does the book come out?
Fall 2020. I don't have a precise date yet, but it's getting there.
All right, so we're going to definitely get him back for that when it hits. The book is going to be titled Divided We Fall. It will be out later this year. But right now, we've had the pleasure of spending time with David French. Thank you so much, David, for coming on the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
All right, folks. Well, that does it for this episode. You know, like I said, you know where to find me on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele and follow David on Twitter. I highly recommend you do at David A. French. Looking forward to the next time we get to meet and chat, folks. Until then, be blessed. Take care.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.